Hello, and welcome to another episode of East in the Arena, a place where we talk to East members about the unique things they do, why they do them, and how. Jeremy Levin here. And if you're like me, you know that one of the hardest things we do with our job, and perhaps the most nebulous, is the goals of care discussion. For the uninitiated, it's this incredibly intimate and crucial conversation that's had between providers and their patients or families, during which we delineate the severity of the patient's illness, whether our treatments can achieve realistic goals, what are reasonable expectations of treatment, and if all this aligns with what the patient values. And often these discussions are occurring on what's quite possibly the worst day of these patients' or families' lives. So guidance on how to conduct these conversations is crucial in order to provide optimal care for our patients. Enter Lisa Kadotic, an assistant professor of surgery at Yale, who myself, Sean Murley, Mike Radomski, and Andrea Soros had the pleasure of talking to at our live recordings during the 2024 East Scientific Assembly. So Sean, why don't you start us off?
The topic that you brought to our attention was talking about a more protocolized approach to palliative care in the SICU. And we've actually had an episode about palliative care. Go back and listen to that one with Ashley Meager from IU. Tell us a little bit about why you first started that, because we on the podcast really appreciate the importance of the why. So tell us why you started to do what you're working on now.
So I will tell you that we review our trauma, mortalities, morbidities on a weekly basis, as many programs do. And it started with the knowledge that on an almost weekly basis, we were having cases brought to our attention, and the opportunity for improvement was earlier goals of care discussions. You know, and it just occurred to me, this was coming up week after week after week, and it was like, well, how hard can this be? Why are we not doing this? You know, there are good palliative care guidelines from TQIP that say we really should be doing a palliative care assessment within 24 hours. And by that 72-hour mark, you know, we should be having these family meetings. We should be having goals of care discussions. Because I like to think of what we do as the care of patients with time-sensitive surgical disease. You know, so a lot of people don't understand what we do. But if you explain it like that, you know, if you have a problem that is time sensitive that requires a surgeon, you're going to meet us.
If somebody ever asks me what my job is from now on, it is I am the time sensitive hospital surgeon. That is what I am, because I've never heard that before, but I really like that idea. That's
Thank you.
It's going to make explaining it to my in-laws a lot easier. Yeah.
It is often the case that we are the surgeons being called at 3 o'clock in the morning when an older patient, they have a surgical emergency. And now it's us. And it's just us. And these conversations are really important, and I think we do a really good job of it on the whole. You know, maybe we don't do them as frequently or as early as we ought to, but we're really good at it. And we're even seeing patients transferred in with problems that we know are non-survivable. The referring institutions know they're non-survivable, but they're coming to us for the goals of care conversations because it's really difficult to navigate some of these issues. That's where I got interested in this and where we saw a need at our institution to better protocolize our approach to ensuring that the care we provide for our patients aligns with the patient's goals, values, priorities.
What I heard you say is that in our critically ill patients, it is a very complex situation from both a medical, social, psychological perspective, and what you're building is a solution to help with that problem.
I can tell you, being on the receiving end of the information that you're putting out there and the data that's being put out there about this and the push, the drive to that, any support that we have at 3 a.m. to be able to look to say, hey, this is really, you know, if you're going to have this bad talk, this is how you should do it, is just an immense help.
So Lisa sat down about a year and a half ago to draft the first version of her goals of care protocol for her division at Yale. And in it, her asks were relatively simple.
basically documented what it is we should be doing. You know, when we say we're doing goals of care, what do we actually mean by that? We sometimes use that phrase as a euphemism. You know, goals of care does not mean this patient is moribund and is about to die, because guess what? The worst possible time to think about this and do this is in a patient who is dying right in front of you. So basically, I, you know, looked at what available resources were out there, including TQIP Palliative Care Best Practice Guidelines. There is an excellent resource from the American College of Surgeons called Palliative Care Residence Guide. I started sort of compiling a way to go about doing this, you know, timing, approaches, language, you know, what is language we should be using, what is language we shouldn't be using. The words we use matter. I don't know how else to say it, but when you say the phrase withdrawing care, for example, you are implying that you no longer care about a patient who is dying, and that is not true. We care so deeply. I can hardly believe the compassion and empathy that I see. You know, I know you all know what I mean by this, and I think we have to ensure that the language we use reflects what we are doing and how we are truly caring for our patients. You know, I don't think I ever would have imagined that being a trauma and acute care surgeon involves end-of-life care as much as it does. There are patients that need our help with end-of-life care, and ensuring that we have a systematic approach, that all of us are using the same language, are adhering to this protocol I wrote. So it starts with having it written down and saying that this is the way in our shop we do this. Is there a distinction between decision-making, code status, orders, and actually understanding what a patient's goals are? I think there is.
Take us into... Go ahead.
No, you go.
No, you go first.
No, you go first.
No, you first.
Okay. All right, go first.
Can we leave that in?
We may be...
We should.
So when you came up with this protocol, I think palliative care discussions are very... There's certainly a science to it, right? And there's evidence behind how to do them, things that work well. And yet everyone, myself very included, I think we're going to treat like an art, right? There's an art to how you conduct that conversation. And when you get into the science of things, I think people are maybe more so capable of budging because there's hard numbers. But when things are considered an art and I do it this way and I feel like I do it well this way, I could see more resistance to change. So when you came up with this protocol, how quickly were people open to adopting it? And what pushback, if any, did you receive when she's like, hey, this is best practices for something that is a bit vague?
You know, pushback is challenging. I've got some partners who are a little bit older than me and still have this idea that as surgeons, even if there is a 0.01% chance that we can fix this problem, that we need to fix that problem. And that fix-it model mentality is maybe part of the culture, maybe part of the dogma, but we gotta change that a little bit, because patients want to know how best they can receive care that will be of benefit to them. And I think we have to do a better job of aligning that. It is still, I think, one of the most difficult things we do to care for patients at the end of life, to support families through that process. And some people are better at it. However, there are ways to empower individuals who maybe have less comfort, less familiarity. I think of this no differently than, you know, how do we manage DVT prophylaxis in TBI patients? It is part of what we do. And the vagueness, the sort of art aspect, I think we have to get beyond that so that we can ensure that patients are receiving optimal, high quality, beneficial care and avoiding care that doesn't align with their goals and values, avoiding care that's non-beneficial. I always think of the effect-benefit principle. You know, the effect that we have on a patient through an intervention is on some part of their body. But if I patch the hole that's been caused by an eroding tumor, will that actually benefit the patient as a whole? You got to think about that a little bit and then make sure the patient understands that.
I did best case, worst case training because we're a participating center. And someone made the quip like, well, the worst case is always going to be death. And I was like, no. It's like sometimes there are many cases where I'm like, that's the best case scenario. And, you know, the effect of our treatment does not lead to a benefit. I never actually heard it distilled to that principle, but I think of that all the time with these palliative discussions. Like, there are many things we can do to make people live or survive, maybe, is it better? They survive. They can survive the insult, but you wouldn't call what they're in the state they're in afterwards living.
So you wrote this, did you call it a protocol or clinical practice guideline? What did you call it?
We called it the Goals of Care Protocol.
Okay. Now tell us, what are the components of that protocol?
We started by identifying populations in whom we needed to be addressing goals of care. And we started with our trauma and emergency surgery patients. And we included all patients age 65 and older, but also any patients with a significant life-threatening injury or a life-threatening diagnosis. And then, you know, this, the timing, so we were basing this really on the TQIP palliative care best practice guidelines. And the protocol, as it were, is for surgical intensive care unit patients. So within 24 hours, we need to identify patients that would fall into this protocol, identify who the surrogate decision maker is for that patient, determine code status, and part of that is having a larger goals of care conversation, which we aim to do within 72 hours because sometimes there are other factors that play into, you know, what goes on. I will tell you, sometimes I am having goals of care conversations in the trauma bay. You know, that is not an uncommon scenario. And again, you can discuss goals of care in the context of a standardized family meeting format, but you don't always have to. Trying to establish that first meeting, certainly sooner rather than later, and at the time of imminent death is definitely not the right time to do it. But you know what? Sometimes we encounter patients and those conversations have to take place immediately. Once we've established patients who fall into the protocol, we establish timing, and then sitting down and thinking about the different components of goals of care. So understanding the patient's baseline function, understanding their goals, their values, their priorities, what matters to them. What would they want in this situation? Well, nobody wants to be critically ill. Nobody wants to be facing a life-threatening diagnosis. So I think saying, well, what would your loved one choose? And then providing those options, you know, that is part of making the diagnosis, offering information about prognosis, best case, worst case. I think in our discipline, we're almost always facing a decision. And then framing that for the family, for the patient, in a way that's manageable, understandable, and trying to ensure that we have a treatment plan that will align with those goals and values.
You mentioned sort of language do's and don'ts, if you could kind of run through that.
And do you include those language do's and don'ts in your protocol, or is it just part of the education? Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So the language do's just and don'ts are in the written protocol. So language don'ts. Should we restart your heart if it stops? That's not something we should say.
I say that all the time.
Yeah. Well, so this is why I asked this question. Because I was like, how many am I going to check into Jones' catalog? Probably a lot.
And maybe this goes back to some of the art, but withdrawing care, you shouldn't say that. Pulling the plug, definitely shouldn't say that.
I don't say that one. Don't say that one.
I don't know. Do people say that? It's. I'm sure it's out there.
It's something you hear on TV a lot. I bet that's that make
just pull the plug
permeate into our.
I've had patients say that to me. Like, I want you to pull the plug, and I'm like, all right, we'll start comfort care. Yeah. That's fine.
You know, do you want us to do everything? So. That's problematic because, well, what does do everything mean? You know, when I have a patient who is, has been transitioned to comfort care measures and they are, you know, at the end of life, I can assure you I am doing everything for that patient. You know, what is much more helpful is asking a patient, what matters to you? What are you worried about? Asking the family what they're worried about. Telling a family, I'm going to ensure that your loved one is comfortable and doesn't suffer.
How has this impacted the interaction with your palliative care service? I assume at Yale you have a palliative care service.
When do you
right?
get them installed?
Yes. Yeah. I joined Yale in the height of COVID. And when I came, our palliative care, specialty palliative care services are a strained resource, even in the best of times. And during COVID, our palliative care service was not seeing patients in person at all. So it was us. And we had COVID patients in our intensive care unit. We didn't have a separate COVID ICU. You know, if a surgical patient also had COVID, they were cared for in our unit. So it quickly became apparent how important primary palliative care services are. Our palliative care service is terrific. However, they're not available 24/7 and really only consulting specialty palliative care services for really challenging scenarios. You know, then we will certainly get the palliative care service involved. But I've found that for some situations, the acuity of the situation just does not allow for a multidisciplinary approach.
I think I picked this up in residency. Do you remember Dr. Dobbs with palliative care? She'd sometimes be like, I'm Dr. Death. She's lovely, lovely person. I wonder where she's at now. She was such an amazing palliative care physician.
I feel like Dr. Death has a different connotation.
There's the yeah. spinal surgeon.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I think that's a different podcast,
Jeremy. Chris Dunt.
Yeah, this is like 10 years ago. Okay. I learned a lot from her palliative discussions. And one of the things that tools that she would employ was acknowledging the impossibility that the situation is placing on family members, right? Because often many families have never had discussions about what would you happen if something that is very commonplace in our world, but is not normal in any other frame of reference.
Yes.
And she would say it's okay to acknowledge the family who's feeling that impossible. Like, what would your family members say to this for something that no one has ever really considered? It's okay to acknowledge that impossibility. And that kind of helps facilitate getting past it. Like, okay, we all acknowledge this is really tough. This is near impossible to decide. But the burden of making these decisions is upon us, and we're here to help you through the impossible, for the hard, or stuff like that.
And it's true. It is a huge burden on families, and there is this impossibility to it because nobody can expect the things that go on. And that is why, you know, advanced care planning is great. You know, I would much rather have advanced care planning documentation than not. But at the same time, advanced care planning is for future hypothetical situations that nobody, you can only be so clear about sort of what you want in the future, but you can never truly address, you know, what ought to be done for a future version of yourself, which we could go off on a whole tangent about that. You know, you can never predict for the actual scenario that you will find yourself in, and you don't know how your goals, values, and priorities might change with a future version of yourself. There is plenty of data from spinal cord injury patients who, you know, nobody would want that sort of thing to happen, but if it has happened, your outlook, your quality of life may be a whole lot better than you thought it would be. You know, that's where Goals of Care truly addresses the here, the right now, the actual situation that we are actually facing at this moment in this hospital, right here, right now. And that's where we come in. That's where we have to navigate based on the best information we can gather from family, from friends, from collaterals. And thank goodness that you do have family and friends most of the time who can speak on a patient's behalf, because the patient who has no one to speak on their own accord, who needs a conservator, those are some of the hardest scenarios. And that's really where we, you know, have to load the boat and get multidisciplinary expert help.
Earlier, you mentioned that you don't really keep track of compliance with using this protocol. What metrics are you looking at, if any? Are you trying to track any documentation compliance or?
At least informally, are already starting to do this with our trauma performance improvement process. You know, anytime there's mortality or a significant morbidity, we are looking at when was the first advanced care planning document filed in the chart. It is also the case now that in concert with what we've done, we didn't have a whole lot to do with this, but our entire healthcare system has updated the way that we record code status. And it used to be the case that our code status was somewhat incongruent. It could be the case that someone is full code, but don't intubate them in the event of cardiac arrest. And we used to have that kind of, you can pick from column A, you can pick from column B, you can do this, you can do that. It absolutely drove me bonkers. But now we have finally addressed that problematic issue with our code status.
The nurses are right at the bedside, and they're always impacted by this decision. And frankly, they sometimes initiate the discussions early, which is always helpful. What role do the nurses play at your hospital?
You've touched me close to my heart. I'm married to a surgical intensive care unit nurse. So I think perhaps part of this goes way back to residency. When I met my husband, technically we did not meet at work in the hospital. We met at a holiday party organized by the Department of Surgery. Thanks, Dr. Julie Freischlag. It's true. So my husband worked in the intensive care unit for a long time, and I would see the moral distress that he would sometimes have from caring for certain patients. You know, I still think of one patient in particular from my training. My husband will know exactly who it is because we both cared for this patient for a very long time. I think that patient embodied the consequence of not asking patients what they want or allowing for goals of care conversations, or allowing for the possibility that what we are doing may not align with what this patient truly wants. And that is a huge source of burnout, of injury to our nursing colleagues, that I wish we could have done something differently. You know, the outcome for that patient, he died eventually, but not after a very long time of suffering, of living in that intensive, living, you know, surviving, sort of being in that intensive care unit, but not being able to survive outside of that intensive care unit in any meaningful way. And why did we do this? You know, why? And I think the patient asked himself that question too, and he would plead, you know, every day. But I will tell you that I listen to our nurses. And if they are bold enough to bring forth a concern, I will absolutely listen to that nurse and act on what they are saying. It gets back to the fact that surgical intensive care unit nurses know what they are doing, and they have good intuition. They are often the ones nudging us, hey, don't forget, you need to have goals of care conversations. The nurses, I think, are some of the best patient advocates and really serve a critical role in ensuring that we provide optimal care.
Where is this going? What's the next steps for you, and where do you see the future of your protocol and your program as a whole going for palliative care?
I think all protocols are local. You know, what you do at your place works at your place. However, I think it's given me a little bit of a voice, you know, because you all welcomed me here to talk about this for some reason. I don't know.
The whole purpose of the podcast.
You know, and it's certainly allowed me to self-identify as somebody who is interested in this at our institution. It's allowed for some other opportunities in terms of collaborating with some ethicists. It's certainly opened the door for me in terms of some additional opportunities to think critically about this, collaborate, and hopefully improve the way we do this on a national scale. What are the next steps at our own institution? Hopefully closer monitoring in terms of ensuring adherence to the protocol, making sure we are having these earlier goals of care conversations so that week after week we don't have to hear the same thing at trauma performance improvement, and hopefully measuring some of this. You know, I would love to actually study this and publish it. And then, you know, bigger picture, I hope this is an area where I can continue, you know, efforts and maybe someday claim to have made a meaningful impact in how we do what we do when it comes to caring for critically ill and injured patients. And I will tell you that there really are no metrics. You know, there are no good metrics to ensure that the care we provide aligns with the patient's goals and values. If you can tell me one, if anybody can tell me one, tell me, because that's the holy grail. There are no metrics. So if we were to figure out a way to develop metrics to ensure that we are doing this and measuring how well we do it, I think that would be a lifetime of achievement.
Well, that's us. Thanks to Lisa for joining us for our live recordings at the 2024 East Scientific Assembly. And stay tuned, as we're going to have more recordings coming up throughout the year. East in the Arena is a product of the Educational Resources Committee. If you'd like to hear more East in the Arena or other East products such as the TraumaCast or CareerCast, visit east.org or wherever fine podcasts are found. And we're always looking for feedback, so visit the east.org website and visit our webpage and click the Submit Us Your Feedback link. We want to hear your thoughts. This episode was storyboarded, engineered, and edited by Jeremy Levin and co-produced by Sean Murley. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode of East in the Arena.
Give a shout out to my dad, because he will find this podcast and listen to it about 15 times. He's not a doctor. He's a retired police officer, but I will assure you that he's going to find this and listen to this.
We're keeping this bit in right here. Yes, for him.
For him. So, hi, Dad. I know you're going to listen to this about 20 times.
The discussion is the opinion of the participating individuals. East does not recommend or endorse and disclaims all liability relating to any particular products, procedures, opinions, or other information presented or referred to on or through this podcast, including but not limited to the content of any advertisement, except for any statements specifically identified as expressing a policy or position officially approved by East.